Herzlich willkommen bei MQ zum Hören. Mein Name ist Bettina Leidl, Direktorin des Museumsquartier Wien, und ich freue mich, euch die Diskursvielfalt im Museumsquartier auch akustisch näher zu bringen. Ihr erhaltet spannende Einblicke in Kunst, Kultur, Nachhaltigkeit und Diversität. MQ Gespräche.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome here to the Libelle in the Museums Quartier. My name is Sabine Kreuzenbrunner. I'm the Secretary General of the Bruno-Kreisky Forum. We are very much delighted to continue in this cooperation with the Museums Quartier, also RD Foundation, for this evening. Let me first give a warm welcome to our speaker, Michael Siegert. Welcome.
Thanks so much.
Acclaimed journalist, author, columnist of The Spiegel, and he will be introduced in greater detail to you by Philipp Blom, curator and moderator, renowned historian and journalist. Thank you also for being with us. Welcome. I just want to say two things not related to the very, very many questions that will come up in relation to the book, of course, that I found it particularly interesting that we translated the German title into English, whereas the original title is actually The Other Side, The Dark Side of the Earth. The Dark Side of the Earth. My comment to that in brief, not going into this book, which is highly interesting, and I advise you to buy and read it, is the notion of cynicism. And so maybe a title maybe even more to the point would be The Dark Side of Humankind. The ideology of cynicism in relation also to the development of the term, I found particularly appealing and also very relevant to the times we now see. And if I may quote very briefly, everyone's a cynic, a few will admit it. And today's cynics excuse themselves half-heartedly. I hate to be a cynic, but before making their pronouncements. Narrowly opportunistic, always on the take, contemporary cynicism has nothing positive to contribute. The cynicism of the ancient Greeks, however, was very different, bold and shameless. It was committed to transforming the values on which civilization depends. In this long history of cynicism, from the fearless speech of the Greek cynics in the 4th century before Christ, to the contemporary cynics' lack of social and political convictions, we have gone a long way. And this idea of this lack of social and political convictions, the idea that actually we face a similar situation all over the world and it's not really worthwhile to engage socially, politically, this, I think, has become a very predominant notion. With this, I hope that in this talk today, this evening, we will sort of look into Russia, into today's Russia, into the history of Russia, but also, of course, in relation to Europe and how we reflect and see the future of the relation and in this context. I wish you a very interesting talk. I'm sure it will be the case, and also an interesting Q&A session. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Sabine, and good evening also in the name of the Museumsquartier. Bettina Leidl is sitting here and she gave me permission to shorten the introduction process by welcoming you in her name as well. It's really thrilling to have Michael Siegert here and to speak with him about the end of the Soviet Union, but of course also about contemporary Russia and perhaps a little more. Michael is a very well-known journalist in Russia. He was the editor-in-chief of Deutsche TV, which he also happened to found, and he had to leave Russia in 2022 for some reason. He found the weather more agreeable in New York, and there you are now. Michael, before we start...
Questionable choice.
But yes, I mean, you wanted to get away from dictatorship, so perhaps...
Luckily.
Yes.
Did that.
tick. But tell us a little bit before we sort of dive in and also pick up from what Sabine Kreuzenbrunner just told us. Tell us a little bit about yourself. How do you become a liberal journalist in Russia, and when did you know that it was time to go?
Okay, we start with the first season of our TV series. It's going to take time. When I was a kid, I was a war correspondent. Literally, I was 21 when I went to Iraq, and the first 10 years of my career as a journalist, when my peers and my classmates were clubbing and having fun in Moscow, I was going to Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Palestine, Darfur. I was covering revolutions color revolutions in former Soviet Union. So that's how my work started. Basically, many years after that, I would say a few years ago, I realized why I decided to become a war correspondent in the first hand. Why I really wanted to go to the war as a journalist when I was 21. And that was not a simple question for me, because I was questioning myself. Was it adrenaline? Was it desire to risk my own life? And in the end, I realized that the answer was, it was very hard question. And the answer was very simple. I didn't want anyone to suspect that I was gay. And that's why I wanted to be very masculine and very strong and the bravest guy, the toughest man in the room. And I did it. And that's why I spent 10 years in the war with myself.
The gay pride parade here is tomorrow. You know
that. I was walking here and I watched the preparations. Yeah. So that's why probably I decided to start with that shocking detail of my biography. So then, after 10 years of working as a war correspondent, I decided to find something more peaceful and calm. So I became the founding editor-in-chief of Russia's only independent news TV channel. What could be easier and more peaceful than that? We didn't know that it was not possible. We didn't know, none of us was... had an experience of working for television. I was working for newspaper before that, and I was briefly editing Newsweek in Russia. But we started that TV channel, and it became probably the only independent news TV channel. It became the reason and the driving force behind the huge protest rallies in Russia in 2011, 2012. Those years, I had a lot of illusions, and I was sure that...
What were your illusions?
I was sure that we were prevailing. I was sure that definitely Putin is doomed, because no one really believes in that. And the new generation is completely different, and he's not able to drag all those people to the past, to the Soviet Union. I was very delusionally optimistic. Our TV channel was nearly destroyed in 2014, just a month before Crimea annexation. We lost. We were kicked out of all streaming platforms, all cable networks. We became online TV channel, and still we continued working, and the TV channel is still broadcasting right now. It had to leave Russia in 2022, and now it's broadcasting from Amsterdam, but in a way we managed to survive. At the same time, approximately those years, I started writing books, because I decided that that TV channel was very important, but since we lost majority of our audience, we started kind of preaching to the flock, and that was a problem for me. I knew that to work for the future, we need to find new audiences. We need to talk to younger people. We need to shape their values, because those people who were our audience, and mostly that was 60 plus, they had already known. They had been with us for years, and they didn't need extra education. And I decided to, in 2015, I quit the TV channel and I started my own educational company, focusing on, it was a startup, basically. And we made educational apps. I started writing books about history. Most of them, luckily for me, became bestsellers in Russia. And that was my my another crusade. I was trying to re-educate or educate some people. I still think that it was not in vain. Although right now, as you probably know, 1.5 million of Russia, of citizens of Russia left the country in 2002. And now we are facing that very weird situation when there are two Russias. There is inner Russia within the borders of the Russian Federation, and there is outer Russia, a lot of people who live outside of the territory of Russian Federation still speak Russian, still consume the content created by independent media in exile. Somehow we even face that very unique situation when almost all Russian culture right now is created outside of Russia. That's historical precedent for Russia. Even 100 years ago, when there was a huge exodus after collapse of Russian Empire and Bolshevik Revolution, there were a lot of people who supported the new state, and a lot of like geniuses like Maikovsky, Eisenstein, and so on and so forth. Bloch. Now we don't have that. Now we see that nothing, no art is created in Russia, but a lot of art, literature, movies, theater performances are created in Russian, outside of Russia, mostly in Europe. So we live in that very weird, distorted reality when we are trying to work for the virtual country. And at the same time, we are trying to reach those people who live there in Russian Federation. We hope that, I don't know why I started this conversation right from the beginning, but I hope that everything we do now is not in vain. Although, I live in New York. I'm writing in English as well as in Russian. I write op-eds for the New York Times and for Der Spiegel. I teach in Columbia and in Yale. Trying to, it's funny that when Donald Trump was elected to president, my daughter was making fun of me. She congratulated me with, you wanted to leave the country with a shitty dictatorship, and you moved from Russia to America. Good luck.
Yeah, well done.
Yeah.
That brings me to something that Sabine already alluded to, and that brought you first to my attention, and that was when you made a simile that I found very uncomfortable and very telling. You said, you know, back in Moscow now, people are talking about whether Washington is now not having its 1989 moment, because 1989 was the collapse of the Soviet Union, and you said, the Soviet Union collapsed because people no longer believed the official ideology and they became cynical. And yes, when you look at America like that, who believes the official ideology and, you know, how cynical are people? It was quite an uncomfortable moment. Can you elaborate a little bit like that? And where did you see that going since?
You know, that was an idea very popular in Moscow, I would say, 2 years ago, and even last year, that the obvious fact that was liberal democracy is not fashionable any longer. And it's not a secret for all of us that we used to live in the world for so many years, especially 20 years ago, even maybe 10 years ago, when it was still clear that there is a progress and we are going towards more democratic world. More and more countries were trying to become more democratic. And unexpectedly, we are in the world where it's completely out of fashion. And somehow cynicism is the new black. It's fashionable to be cynical, not idealistic. And in a way, Donald Trump is that globe before it was Vladimir Putin, but now it's Donald Trump, the prophet of the global cynicism. And I was really surprised when I first, I would say 2 years ago, I was talking to one of my sources in Moscow, and he told me that some people in the Kremlin called Donald Trump American Gorbachev. And I was like, Trump? Gorbachev? How come? And the explanation was very unusual, because Gorbachev was the Soviet leader who stopped believing in Soviet ideology and embraced the ideology of the enemy. And somehow that, because of that, he led the country to its collapse. Just the same way they were expecting Trump to do the same. He definitely does not believe in liberal democracy, which is the cornerstone of the American statehood. He definitely embraced something that can be called current Russian official ideology, which is cynicism. And we don't know where he's driving his country, but that was a very nice concept that was discussed in the Kremlin and around Kremlin before American presidential election and during the first months, especially. I cannot say that that's the most popular idea right now, I don't believe that Donald Trump is a Russian asset, and they don't believe in that. But they are very happy with chaos. They are very always happy with chaos and happy with everything Trump is doing. I've heard recently. I've heard the phrase attributed to one of the most high-ranking bureaucrats in Russia. He said, one day we'll make a monument to that orange guy. And if we're really lucky, we'll erect this monument in Kiev.
Just before I came here, I listened to an interview with Errol Musk, the father of Elon. And Daddy was just back from St. Petersburg, where he was at the St. Petersburg Economic Forum. And he had taken with him somebody called Tommy Robertson, actually called Stephen Lennox Yaxley, I believe, but who calls himself Tommy Robinson, who is the leader of the far-right British nationalists. And the interviewer asked Mr. Musk what had taken him to Moscow, and he said in his beautiful South African accent, when you come to Russia, you realize it's a clean country. It's clean. It's very, very clean. It's also very advanced, but it's exceedingly clean, and they're godly people and much more advanced. And then he said, touchingly, and look around yourself, he said, and Europe is now, by comparison, like a dirty African kraal. And that sort of drew a very nice image, I think, of a mental horizon that people may have.
I would add to that among other distinguished guests of St. Petersburg Economic Forum, besides Errol Musk, there was Andrew Tate, also who is very known for his...
the king of the manosphere, yes.
Cleanliness, yeah. And Candace Owen...
There's a certain fascist obsession with purity that one could spend a whole evening on. But what I really wanted to ask you is, I mean, where Mr. Musk's come from, I think I know. But you've spent a lot of time now in the West, more or less voluntarily. You've spoken to a lot of educated and not so educated people in the West. What do we get wrong about Russia?
I think the same that we get wrong about Russia. You know, I start getting mad when I hear anyone talking about mysterious Russian soul. Just, I I want to kill myself. And that's one of the most popular topic among Russian intellectuals. And that's actually that idea about Russian exceptionalism. It could work any other way. It could be as Russians as God-bearing people, which is basically Dostoevsky wrote that. He was kind of playing with that idea in the Demons, but he was not 100% serious. But still, he believed from his letters, we know that he really believed in that. We can remember that Pyotr Chadaev wrote that Russia is a country of slaves and all Russians will always be slaves, and that's the same coin, the other part of the same coin. Idea that Russians are different and there is some kind of Russian soul.
Today you could read Alexander Dugin.
Yeah, that's the second thing that everyone gets wrong is Alexander Dugin, because everyone somehow thinks calls him Putin's Rasputin, brain of
just sounds so nice.
Yeah, but that's wrong. Dugin has never met Putin in person. He has no influence. He is the super demonized ultra fascist from Moscow. But he is, so they do it without him. Dugin is is really marginal figure. But if we're talking about what I think we get wrong about Russia is that idea of Russian exceptionality. And every time I hear that Russia is there is some kind of Russian DNA that makes it inevitable that Russia has to be an empire and forever will be an empire, that's such a ridiculous assumption. I will tell you more. Last year I was in Yale, and there is a very interesting very famous professor of history, Arne Vestad. He's Norwegian, and he wrote an amazing book about World War III, in which he draws parallels between the upcoming World War III and First World War. So he compares China to Germany, saying that these are China is just like Germany 100 years ago, is the new upcoming superpower that missed the previous phase, and they are trying to conquer and to get what they couldn't get during the previous decades. And then he makes another parallel, that there is another, in today's world, there is another empire that thinks that it is still an empire and doesn't realize that everything is in the past, that it is not able to remain an empire any longer, that actually it's gone. And his parallel is obviously between Russia and Austria-Hungary. So I think that's more or less, although no historical parallel usually work. I don't believe in those laws of history, so it's all poetry. But I think that's a very good poetry. Russia is not doomed to be an empire, and I think we that assumption that nothing changes is very wrong. Historically, we see that everything changes everywhere, every time. So Russia is going to be a very different country in 30 years, I would say, and that's the important beginning of the conversation.
You mentioned Arne Vestad. Let me mention another historian, also because he's here, Christopher Clark. Christopher Clark wrote about the beginning of the First World War, that the sleepwalkers, that the elites were effectively so deluded, so had so much eaten their own story, were so much in thrall of their own idea of themselves, and didn't talk to each other and misunderstood each other. And the First World War was basically started through a cascade of incompetence, if I may paraphrase, rather than through the singular mastermind ill intention or evil intention of any one actor.
First World War. It always happened.
No, but this is a question about deluded elites. And you can ask yourself about deluded elites in Russia, but you can also ask yourself about deluded elites in the West. I remember that at the beginning of the war, Germany's generous contribution to the Ukrainian war effort was the offer of 5,000 helmets. That sounds quite quaint today, but what don't we understand about this process that is happening at the moment? Because processes that we know have their own dynamics. And once they start, they're very difficult to stop. So what process are we in at the moment with Russia? And what are we not understanding that we should understand?
I should add that knowing how weird was assumption of the war in the beginning, still there was, since the beginning of the war, a strategy about Ukraine. And that's very important, and that's like definitely it's one of the best what happened to Europe during the last years. That's unity in support of Ukraine. That's really...
It's always good to have a decent enemy if you want to unite.
But the problem is that there was no strategy about Russia, just as there was no strategy about Belarus, about anything else. There is no idea, and there was no idea, what to do with Russia. And definitely, we know that sanctions are not working.
I disagree. There wasn't a clear idea what to do with Russia. Russia was delivering more than 50% of all natural gas to Germany. It was driving the German car industry. They knew exactly what to do with Russia, to keep on very nice cordial relations. Without Russian gas, German industry would have shut down.
That's an irony, but that's not a strategy what to do with the country you are kind of, you call it an enemy, and you are starting sanctioning it, but you don't really know what you want to achieve. Because definitely there is no goal what the West wants to achieve about Russia. About the current dynamics, we saw that that this year was somehow a turning point. Somehow Russian economy finally not because of Western sanctions, but mostly because of the incompetence of the of Russian government and because of everything what is happening in the country, Russian economy finally is in danger. Most big businesses and mid-level businesses are on the verge of bankruptcy. The government is running out of money, and the psychological atmosphere is very different from what was happening 2 years ago or even last year. Last year, a lot of people were saying, "Yes, we shouldn't have started this war, but since we've started it, we have to win it." That was kind of a consensus of the elites in Moscow. And now it's gone. Now it's completely different. Now everyone is so tired. And that's that sickness of the population of Russia is the result of the actions of Russian government. Because when they started blocking internet, that finally population of Russia realized that it's impossible to pretend that war is not happening. So it was Russian government that finally made the population of Russia really exhausted and started really hating this situation and this war. But somehow there was... economically, Russia was really close to a huge crisis, but someone helped. An unexpected beginning of the war in Iran really helped. The oil prices are skyrocketing, and sanctions against Russian fertilizers were lifted. So basically, that change can cover the budget deficit till the end of the year. But still, nevertheless, it's clear that psychologically everything changed. This fall in September, there is the parliamentary election in Russia. We know a Duma election. We know that election in Russia is not a real election. It doesn't mean that someone is expecting that voters would come to the polling stations and would say their word. But still, the situation is very turbulent. Every time when elections are approaching, there are intrigues behind the curtain. And right now, we definitely see those clashes between different clans because everyone is unhappy with the current role of FSB and with our internet outages. The idea to block internet and to leave only whitelisted websites is crazy. And for elite, for small businesses, for mid-level, for business, for middle class, that's a catastrophe. That's much worse than anything. So we see that the situation is completely different, and it's going to be very much more turbulent in summer, in the fall. There are clashes between different groups in the elites. For example, the Kremlin promised to have as many as 150 special military operation veterans in the new parliament, and it means that they were going to be selected by the person who is the curator of the domestic policy, Sergei Kiryenko. But then defense minister stood up and said, no, you are choosing wrong veterans, I'm going to choose right veterans. So the clash started between Kiryenko and Belousov, who is going to handpick the future parliamentarians who are going to represent the veterans of the special military operation. And Belousov won, so we are going to have real veterans in the parliament, so 150 micro-Prigozhins are going to be so it's coming. The situation is started really changing.
Happy news for Russian democracy. The subtitle of your book in English is Russia's Brief Victory Over Totalitarianism. I paraphrase, but what I'm interested in, and I think what many people in the West are interested in, is why was this victory so brief? I mean, a frequent answer in the West is, well, the Russians have never had any experience with democracy. There was a kind of democratic government for a few months in 1917. But apart from that, really, it's difficult to find where you can find Russian democracy and how could they? But this, as your book suggests, is a far too easy answer. And there's also a lot to be said with effectively having had a second revolution and not having thought about it, reflected about it, seen, understood the impact on society. Can you tell us a little bit about this idea of the brief victory over totalitarianism and the relapse?
Of course, but I must say that you definitely know that sometimes the author cannot influence the subtitles or even titles of his books.
I have been told that, yes.
Yeah, this book in every language is called The Dark Side of the Earth, except for German. And actually, the Russian subtitle of the book is the story of how Soviet people defeated the Soviet Union, which is completely different idea. But yes, definitely there is an explanation what happened, why after Soviet collapse, Russia did not become a proper democracy, or there are a lot of different people. I interviewed more than 200 participants or witnesses. And for example, members of the first Russian democratic government, Gaidar's government, the reformers' government, for them, the most important answer was the West, that Russia was not offered any kind of Marshall Plan, they are saying. Because, yeah, definitely when Soviet Union, not even Russia, former Soviet republics, there was no intention to bring them to the European family. Neither Russia nor Ukraine, Belarus. It was different with the Baltics, but with Russia, more or less, it was the bear is dead. Let's forget about it. It will never come back. Partly that's true, but that's I'm not the one who would blame the West for all Russian problems, because definitely there were a lot of, like, most problems were caused by Russian leaders and by Russians. There was definitely Russian founding fathers just did not realize the fact that they had to be founding fathers of new state. Andrei Sakharov, the greatest Soviet dissident, a Nobel Prize winner, was probably the only person who had that vision and who had that responsibility, who knew that they had to start the foundation of something completely different. He was writing the constitution of the Democratic Soviet Union. He died in 1989, 2 years before the collapse of Soviet Union.
It's very interesting what you write, because when you talk with people in the West, often when you think of heroic Soviet dissidents, you get Alexander Solzhenitsyn. And Andrei Sakharov is, yes, he was also there, but we're not quite sure what he did and what he said. And you draw Solzhenitsyn's profile in quite a different way than what it's seen in the West. And, well, tell us a little bit about that and about the contrast between the two.
Yeah, I would say they are the two main characters of the book. So the most important battle of ideas is between Sakharov and Solzhenitsyn. They are kind of yin and yang of Russian 20th century, just like Tolstoy and Dostoevsky are yin and yang of Russian 19th century, but they symbolize the same idea. Sakharov is liberal democrat. He doesn't recognize Russian values. He says, I don't understand how values, how ideas can have nationality. He believes in global values. He believes that Russia is a normal country, and he believes in convergence, that in the end, socialism and capitalism will become one system based on human rights. And for him, human rights is the basis. And so Solzhenitsyn is clearly, he has completely different point of view. He's Russian nationalist. He is Dostoevsky of 20th century. And he's becoming more and more nationalistic.
You said he would love Trump.
I would say Solzhenitsyn was, yes, the first anti-woke thinker in America. And if we read his Harvard speech of 1976, it was just like what Trump says right now. Solzhenitsyn is in a way a hero for American new right now. He's a very popular figure. Solzhenitsyn is very complicated, because he was really changed. His philosophy has changed dramatically. The moment when he was sent to exile from the Soviet Union to America, what's probably the most interesting example of his philosophy was that in 1974 he wrote so-called a letter to the leaders of the Soviet Union, where he proposed to change Soviet ideology to save the Soviet Union. They should replace communism with Orthodox Christianity. And he proposed to have Russian Orthodox Church as the replacement for the Communist Party of the Soviet Union. Members of Politburo read this letter. They never discussed it. But it's amazing that 15 years later, last head of Soviet KGB, Vladimir Kruchkov, really started trying to fulfill that. He was basically trying to revitalize Soviet Union using the church, and he was trying to convince the hierarchs of Russian Orthodox Church to become new pillars of the Soviet regime. And they, since they honestly told him that it was not possible because they had zero influence, they could not help, they could not become the secretaries of the Communist Party. And even more interesting is the fact that that's exactly what Putin is doing right now. Right now, Russian Orthodox Church is used as that ideological base for the regime. But one important detail is, just like in 89, Russian Orthodox Church doesn't have that influence. Unlike America, Russia is not a religious country. According to all the surveys, less than 1% go to church on Sunday. Although, yeah, everyone identifies themselves as Orthodox, but no, people are still atheists. That Soviet legacy is still there. People are not religious. Russian, and especially Russian Orthodox Church, is very compromised. It's widely seen as the corrupt state-owned corporation.
It still has a lot of propaganda value. I remember a very chilling moment in Moscow. I was making a film and I was on Red Square, and there was some sort of performance going on, which surprised me. And there was a stage that was erected, and it was a sort of medieval operetta that was performed with heroes in suits of armor and maidens in long white dresses and balalaikas playing and e-guitars, and it was all a bit bizarre. And then I learned that it was the celebration of a famous icon that had been brought from Kiev. And there was a representative of Mr. Putin, and there was the Archpatriarch of the Orthodox Church, and they celebrated the mystical unity between Kiev and Moscow and the Ukraine and Russia. That was 2011, and I found that an interesting moment. So there obviously had been some preparation already to prepare hearts and minds, and not only military budgets. But before I open up this conversation to the public, and I'm sure we're also going to come to some more contemporary questions about today and tomorrow. One of the persons that you spoke a lot to, not just for your book, but anyway, was a very pivotal person. And there's always this idea in history that in a really pivotal moment, you have to have it, personality matters a lot. You can imagine what would have happened in South Africa without Nelson Mandela. So you spent quite a lot of time with Mikhail Gorbachev. You knew him. And was he the right leader for this transition at that moment?
You know, Mikhail Gorbachev was an amazing human being. He was a very, very nice person. Very good person. And, you know, I always, when I talk to Americans, I usually compare him to Jimmy Carter, because I think that's the same type of the person. Amazing human being, not a genius statesman.
About Jimmy Carter, they usually said he initialed all official papers with JC, and that looked a little bit like Jesus Christ. And,
you know, you would be surprised, but when Gorbachev was telling the story of his birth, he was saying that I was born in a barn, just like Jesus. I'm not exaggerating. I heard this joke from him dozen of times. But Gorbachev was a very nice person. He really loved his wife, and that's very important. I really mean it, because, you know, I do believe that not only the First World War was started because of stupidity of politicians. I do believe that stupidity is the driving force of history. So everything is happening because of incompetence, stupidity, or sometimes because of good idealism, because of love or absence of love, or absence of sex, or people having sex. So it matters, and definitely the source of idealism for Gorbachev was his wife Raisa. She was she had PhD in sociology. She was a very she was much more educated person. And I remember that phrase he was saying, that he has always known that if only his hands were covered with blood, she would never go to bed with him. And for him, that was really important. So in a way, he really... So everything in this world changed because of that love, because he really could not afford having blood on his hands. Did he have a plan? No, he did not. Was he trying to make something better? Yes, definitely he was. Did he make a lot of mistakes? Yes, definitely he made a lot of mistakes. But in the end, we know that he was not the popular politician after the collapse of Soviet Union. Probably he was one of the least popular politicians in Russia, which was becoming better last years, because the younger generation was kind of kinder to Gorbachev. But I sincerely believe that in the end, after in few decades, our Russian perception of Gorbachev will be completely different. Because after all, he is the person who gave us 30 years of peace. And because of his idealism, and because of the fact that he decided to end the Cold War, we had 30 years when the governments were not spending all of the money to produce weapons. We have everything, our current technologies, healthcare, science, education, because during the last 30 years, we had that vacation. And a lot of money were spent not on the war, not all on the arms. And that vacation is over. So thanks to Gorbachev, we had that.
What ended the vacation? Why did the vacation end?
Because of Putin, I guess. We know
yes,
that.
But I mean, yes, but yeah? You know, power is never something somebody possesses. Power is always something that is given to someone by others. Putin doesn't have power if his generals say, "Are you crazy? I'm not going to do that." So there's a system that supports him. It's not just one crazy person who has got an idea of his place in history. So again, you know, why did this? I mean, perhaps the democratic vacation in America is ending, but why did it end in Russia?
You know, it didn't end in Russia. It didn't start in Russia. Russia did not have proper democracy in the 90s. During the post-Soviet years, there were only two working democratic institutions, and they were working, and they were, both of them were doing everything to try to make Russia a different place. I mean, independent media existed in Russia till 2022. Now all of them are in exile, but still there was like a real fight for a better democratic society. And that was the second institution, which is education system. Russian education was very decent. And we see the proof, what is being done right now with professors, with faculty. They are writing new textbooks. They are firing rectors of the universities. So yes, it was, we had that hope, because the educational system was very liberal. And so, but we never had free and fair elections. We never had the independent judiciary. We never had all other important institutions. And unfortunately, all years of Putin's presidency, and it does mean that it was doomed from the beginning. No, there were a lot of, I believe we were discussing with you before the beginning of this conversation, the turning points. I believe that there were a lot of turning points. a lot of turning points. There were possibilities to that Russia could have become very different place. For example, after the end of the coup in 1991, there was such a happy moment. Everyone remembers it. The putsch was defeated. Yeltsin and Democrats were triumphant. And what happened next? Yeltsin went to Sochi for 2 months and he didn't appoint new government. For 2 months, Soviet Union didn't have, like, Soviet,
he had a little drinking.
Soviet government resigned because they were involved in the coup, and Gorbachev could not appoint a new government because he couldn't do it without Yeltsin, and Yeltsin was drinking for 2 months, September and October of 1991. There were a lot of other turning points. Let me give you a very unexpected example. In 2008, a new American administration proposed a new approach to Russia, and it was called RESET. Hillary Clinton and Sergey Lavrov even pressed that button, reset button. They wrote instead of Перезагрузка, Перегрузка, which is not reset but overload, but it's okay. And it worked. Somehow that policy changed everything because new Russian president, who was Dmitry Medvedev, fell in love with Barack Obama, and he really started acting like not as a person who wanted to be Obama, not Putin. He was proposing new bills. He was clearly behaving like a person who really wanted, he was saying a lot, but he was also doing. He was proposing a lot of very revolutionary liberal bills in Russian parliament. He was going to America. He visited Silicon Valley. He really, he could not fire Putin. But I remember the conversation with Lyudmila Alexeyeva, the great Soviet, another great Soviet dissident. She was very, very old, I would say in her 90s that moment. And I was running TB Rain, and she was the head of Moscow Helsinki Group. And she was telling me that you should know that we should seduce Medvedev. We should recruit him. We should do anything to have him on our side because we cannot fire Putin, but he can. We just need to support him. We need to make him think that he can do that step. And he's on the right path. He just needs to feel his strength. And definitely, I remember that, that his team, his inner circle, was trying to push him. And he didn't get any support, actually, from... So it was our mistake. Russian society never... Russian democratic movement never really started believing in Medvedev. He was pathetic. Everyone was making fun of him, and he didn't. And Americans forgot about him, so they seduced him. He fell in love with Obama. Reset policy worked, and that's it. Although he was doing everything, he voted for invasion in Libya. He voted for all sanctions against Iran. He always sided with Obama against Putin, and that was that. Possibility was not used. I think we are to blame in the first place, and then Obama. But we missed that opportunity. We could do something with that person, and we missed it.
I just have to ask you about one word before I open our conversation, because, well, you just brought it up. I always think the most important overlooked political motivation is humiliation. And certainly in Medvedev's case, that is a big thing. He was humiliated by the West, and he has turned into a sort of Dorian Gray portrait of himself now. But also you could make the same argument for Putin, that he wants to be recognized as the leader of a world power. And it's a country that's very big, but it's no longer a world power. And there is a great deal of humiliation and reaction to humiliation in what the Russian politics are doing today. Do you think that's correct?
I think that's correct. I think, yeah, I think Putin's motivation is definitely the fact that he felt not respected, insulted, and sometimes it was an exaggeration and sometimes it was not. He was persuaded by his spin doctors that the Orange Revolution in Ukraine was American project. That he spent so much money to support his candidate Yanukovych, but still Orange Revolution won. And he could not understand why. And he was told that that's because Americans paid more. They invested much more than you did. And that was the only explanation. But somehow it was not true. But George W. Bush was reelected for the second term right that month. And in his inauguration speech, he made that glamorous speech promising that during his second presidential term he would spread democracy all over the world and bring democracy to every authoritarian regime, as he has already done it in Georgia and Ukraine. So somehow in his inauguration speech he confessed that it was American project, and that for Putin that was a smoking gun. He started thinking that he's going to be the next, that Bush is going for him, that Bush is going to overthrow him. So that's a result of humiliation and misunderstanding and paranoia. And yeah, it's very personal. Everything is very personal.
I can't resist telling you this story. One of the guests that was sitting in your chair before was Ivan Krastev. And Ivan Krastev said, now, there's a certain genre of gangster movie in Russia that was very popular in the early 2000s. And the plot was usually that a gang boss, somebody from the underworld, had made it good, had become rich, and thought it's time to become legit. It's time to, you know, become a businessman and leave this violent world behind me. I've now got my children, my grandchildren to look at. And in these movies, they always find out that the legitimate world is much more brutal and much more full of lies and of hypocrisy than the criminal world they came from, where at least a word was a word. And so they go completely rogue and they want to destroy it all. I don't know whether you recognize this genre of movie, but it certainly seemed to be a nice description of how somebody who had his hands dirty and now wanted to rule with cleaner hands, found himself in a situation that he did not expect.
You know, I was not a fan of those movies, but that's a good description, because for Putin, all Western politicians who are trying to look sane, they're hypocrites. And actually, that was even in the Soviet Union, that was a very important difference between American Democratic Party and Republican Party. They loved dealing with Republicans and they hated Democrats, because in today's Russian political slang, they call Democrats religious people, meaning that their religion is liberal democracy, and they start preaching about their religion, and it's disgusting. It's like, it cannot be true. They are definitely hypocrites. Republicans are at least like more pragmatic. They don't pretend to be pure. So that's Putin's approach, as it was approach of his predecessors. They think that values do not exist. We come back to cynicism. They do not believe that anyone believes in any values. Everyone is the same. There is no democracy. Every politician in the world is corrupt. Every police is brutal everywhere. There is no free and fair elections and no independent media. Oligarchs are everywhere and they control their media. So it's all the same. And you are pretending that you are better than us, but you are just like us.
That's very interesting. The other thing, Ivan Krastev also said that if most people see a crowd of people demonstrating, they ask, what do they want? If Putin sees a crowd of people demonstrating, he asks, who's paid them? But I'm sure you have a lot of questions for Michael Cigar. May I ask you to, questions we love the most are the shortest questions. If you want to have a longer question, that may be possible after the event. But if you've got questions, suggestions, observations, criticisms, this is the ideal moment. I think, yes, there is a microphone behind. There's a lady there whose hand shot up first, and there's another lady next to her whose hand shot up second. So that gives the person with the microphone an easy task.
Yes, thank you very much. Gudrun Steinacker, former German diplomat. I spent a couple of years in Russia in between 2003 and 2011. But I would like to ask you a question for another Russian journalist, Vladimir Solovyov, perhaps the most aggressive propagandist of the Putin regime, gave a long interview in Weltwoche, which is a right-wing Swiss media, to the editor-in-chief only 2 weeks ago. And this interview is amazing. It's in two parts. It's quite long. I don't know if anybody here saw it. Actually, Solovyov is known, you know this, his propaganda, for being very aggressive, threatening atomic bomb attacks on the West, etc. But there he presents himself as a very, very... well-educated man. He spent years in the States, speaks perfectly English, and defends exactly what you just said. A totally cynical world. But the one in Russia is the actual one, the serious and real one. I just want to get a comment on this person and explain this phenomenon. And obviously in Russia, he is successful, and also with all those who are pro-Russian in the West.
Mikhail, before you answer, for those of you who may share my confusion in the audience, Mikhail Solovyov is not the 19th century Christian mystic, but in this case, the very diehard Russian propagandist who has his own television show and is probably the most important voice of Putin on television. So what was your answer?
You know, it's not his opinion. That's the official line. Basically, that idea has become the official line of Russian propaganda after 2012. Actually, after the ideological approach, the rhetorics completely changed. Before that, Putin was trying to play pretend that he's kind of liberal and he cares about middle class. He cares about his partners with in the West. After 2011, 2012, he switched to that. Basically, that was the moment when the TV channel formerly known as Russia Today was rebranded and was called RT, and before it was praising Russia, and since that moment they started offering that new agenda. They are not about Russia; they are about the outside world. They first started promoting conspiracy theories, which seemed to be very popular in many parts of the world. And then they started promoting that concept that everything is the same. There is no democracy in the world. American police is even more brutal than Russian or so. Yeah, that's the narrative of Solovyov and Margarita Simonyan and all of them. It's not there. So do they believe in that? They started believing in that. Are they 100% cynical? Yes, they are. Do they believe in everything they say? No, but they know how to speak passionately.
Please, the lady next. you can jump in straight away.
Yes, thank you. Very simple question. You mentioned that you were like delusional optimist at the beginning when you thought that democracy, the people will take the side of democracy. And now you're mentioning that this is the crucial year about the in Russian economy. And could you be that you're delusional optimist now in terms of economy, because many favor, many constellations in the world are in favor of Russian economy this year?
You know, I may be delusional, definitely, and I have even more hesitations because I don't live in Russia. I left Russia in 2022, and I can talk to some people who live there, and I can check and I can see that the trajectory of the changes in their approach, and but maybe I'm talking to wrong people. Maybe just those people I'm talking to, they are changing, and globally it's all the same. But speaking about being delusional, let me give you one important example why I think why I'm delusional, because I do think that there is not that Russia is not monolith. There are a lot of different Russias. And I'll give you one.
Is that geographical poll, or social?
No. One poll that there was a survey in 2021 made by Livada, which is the only Russian independent polling agency. And their question was very simple: what should we do to LGBT plus people? And respondents older than 60. 60% of them had one answer, which was, your guess, 60% of people older than 60. What should we do to LGBT? Kill them. Exactly, yeah. Death penalty. That was the most popular answer among 60 plus. Then 40 minus. 60% of them say what? No. It should be different. Not the same. Braver, be bolder. Equal rights. They said equal rights. Basically legalize same-sex marriages. 60% of people younger than 40, which is the illustration of the why the book about Soviet Union is important, because it's all about Soviet Union, the Soviet generation, the generation of people who were shaped mentally during the Soviet Union, and people who were mentally shaped after that are very different. People who were born and brought up by internet, by social media, TikTok, Instagram, Facebook, they are very different mentally than the previous generation. The current Russian political elite is still the Soviet generation. Putin spent most of his life in Soviet Union. He was 40 when Soviet Union collapsed. He's 40. He's 74 right now, so most of his life still was Soviet Union. My optimism was based on the fact of my feeling of those upcoming generations, and I was thinking that they matter, they are very different, and one day they are going to take over. I think that gap is one of the most important reasons for the war. I think that this is not the war on. This is mostly not the war for Ukraine, but the war for Russia. He needs this war to control Russia, to conquer Russia, to conquer all those people who are not mentally with him. So that's the reason for me being again and again delusional.
There's another question here in the front, and then we go to the back.
Thank you very much. Hi, just two comments and then a question. The comments, first of all, about the claim that the Germans were not prepared to pay for the geopolitical challenges posed by Putin. I mean, on the eve of the Ukraine war, Germany was drawing 55% of its natural gas from Russia. The figure now is zero. So there's been a really dramatic response to that geopolitical challenge. It hasn't been trivial. And I think it's really important to keep reminding ourselves of this, because There's a lot of talking down of Europe, and in particular of Germany, and I think we should leave it to the Russians to do that. We shouldn't do it ourselves. And I also, thinking about the lack of a Marshall Plan for Russia, well, if you work it all out in inflation-adjusted current value US dollars, then the amount of money paid by the Germans to Russia to lubricate the process of German unification and to pay the Russians off for letting that happen was the rough equivalent of the Marshall Plan money paid to Germany in current value US dollars. And the amounts paid by Western agencies to Russia between 1989 and 2000 come to between 3 and 4 times the total value of the Marshall Plan. So, I mean, there is...
where this data is from? It's unbelievable.
Will you check it out?
I will. It's unbelievable.
But
I'm quoting. It's not. I made it up. Former ministers of Russian government think like that's unbelievable. It's such a surprise for me.
Well, do check it out, because of course there wasn't a Marshall Plan, but what there were loans and various forms of aid, and I'm talking
loans,
about the total value.
And they
of those.
Were returned.
Yeah.
Loans, okay. And all of them were returned.
Yeah, well, some of the Marshall Plan was loans
as
well.
They were ridiculous. They were, like, compared to numbers that was, the iconic dialogue between Gorbachev and Bush. He was trying to compare financial support to Soviet Union to money. Oh, my God. I'm sorry. To money spent on the war in Iraq, and it was like 1%.
Fair enough. But the point is, you would acknowledge, I'm sure, that very large capital transfers occurred between 1989 and 2000, right? To first the Soviet Union, then to Russia, to the Russian Federation. And so all I'm saying is that these are very substantial amounts of money. And although there was no Marshall Plan, one needs to be careful about making that contrast, or at least to quantify it properly. And the question really is, actually, you've come quite close to answering it, is one that Philip asked earlier on. Namely, is there a chance for a liberal Russia? I mean, this is what we all hope for and dream of. And I must say, because I'm striking a slightly critical tone, that I'm very grateful to you for your critical writing over the last years and for the books you've produced. But the question many people are asking is this other Russia that you drew attention to, especially when you talked about LGBTQ attitudes and so on, is there a chance for a better, a more liberal Russia? Or should we join people like Jörg Himmelreich and say, look, it's never going to happen. We should treat Russia as permanently locked in a kind of authoritarian cycle.
You know, many years ago, I wrote a book that was called The Empire Must Die. And it was a book about the collapse of the Russian Empire. And I remember there was a dialogue between Tsar Alexander III and his minister, Sergei Vite, who was the author of the first Russian constitution. He turned Russian Empire to a constitutional monarchy. And Alexander III was fierce anti-Semite. He hated Jews. And he wanted to solve the Jewish question. And Witte's wife was Jewish, so Witte could not support that intention of Tsar, but still he wanted to deal with him. And once, after listening a speech by Alexander III, he told him that I've got two proposals. First, take all the Jews and just Take them to the Black Sea and let all of them sink. We should get rid of all of them. And Alexander III asked, can we possibly technically do that? And Witte said, no. Okay, and what's the second proposal? The second proposal is to let them leave and to be part of the society so they would stop being a problem. That's a weird comparison, but I'm really surprised by your question. Can we get rid of Russia?
No, not rid of Russia. Can Russia become a liberal country? Can Russia become a democratic country? Can there be a liberal Russia in the future?
Could Germany become a democratic country after the end of the Second World War?
Yeah.
yes, can Russia become a democratic country? Can North Korea become? Can North Korea become a democratic country? Please.
Don't be that surprised by my question.
No. I just want to finish my answer. If can North Korea become a democratic country? Definitely. If South Korea could, probably there is nothing genetical about that. It took only 50 years. For one society to become two very different societies. So, your question was very good. Is there a chance? I do think that there is always a chance for any country, for any society. Russia become? Yes,
let's break
Russia
this down
can.
A little bit
I just,
more.
I'm sorry. I just think that pragmatic. That if we want to be pragmatic, we should think about better Russia. We should think about possible allies who exist there. We should think, we should not demonize it, and we should not repeat that mistake.
But Mikhail, nobody has been demonizing Russia. The question is...
No.
Let me break it down.
All sanctions right now are against Russians. We know, like, even for those Russians who fled Russia, especially for those who live in Europe. I don't feel it in America. No one cares about Russia in America, but in Europe, that it's clear that like Russians are problematic. And yes, no, there is. When I was saying that there is no strategy, there is no attempt to find possible allies in Russia. Unlike during the Cold War. During the Cold War, especially during Reagan administration, there was a policy of openness. Tear down this wall, Mr. Gorbachev, he said, and it was a wall built by the Soviets. Now, obviously, there is a wall built by the European Union, clearly. And there is no attempt to split Russian elite. All Russian businessmen, mid-level businessmen who were working in Europe or anywhere else, had their bank accounts frozen and were pushed back to Russia, and they have to live there because they don't have the possibility to move to the US. I think that was a mistake. That was artificial investment boom in Russia. There is no strategy to try to. To have pro-Western Russian elite.
Let me rephrase this question one level down. What would it take for modern Russia to become a liberal democratic country in the next 10 or 20 years? What would have to happen?
First, we are talking as if we live in a democratic world that is becoming better and better. What would it take United States to become
an
authoritarian dictatorship? We live in the worst possible conditions for democracy to flourish. Democracy is unpopular, and authoritarianism is popular. So we have that, you know. Could we imagine that this process would be happening in America? No. So the world is not such an ideal place. What would it take? We have... there was a person who recently was killed in prison in Russia. His name was Alexei Navalny. And his legacy and the most important ideas he was promoting was that Russia is not doomed to be an empire. Russia must be and can be a decent, normal European democratic country. And basically, he died for those ideas. He did not become Russian Nelson Mandela. He probably became Russian Martin Luther King. But I think when a person dies for his values, for democratic values, that's a very powerful message to the next generations. So I think that when values matter, it's really shocking for a cynical country. For a country that does not believe in values. So do I have some hope. Yeah, I have hope that idealism might prevail. Not next year, not this year, maybe in 20 years, but like there is a hope. But actually, Russia cannot be the only country that is turning democratic. There should be some context.
There should definitely be some context. We've got time for one or two more questions. There was a question here. There's a question there. And there's a question over there. Let's take those three. Let's bundle them. Do you still want to ask your question? Did you? Oh, you have got the microphone, yes. So please.
I'll be short, as you ask. Why did you stay in Russia after 2014, and what did you do to prevent 2022?
I was working. I was working in Russia till the last moment when I was allowed to work. I had hope to change Russian society for better. And I think working for being in opposition, being in independent media is a meaningful work. And it was that work was possible. I left Russia when any work was impossible. And I do believe that I did everything. I was in 2014, I was running TV Rain. Was an independent television important for Russia? It was important. It was the only big Russian media to cover what was happening in Ukraine. It was the first Russian media to inform the population of Russia about Russian troops crossing the border and invading East Ukraine in August 2014. We were the first TV channel to verify names of soldiers who were killed in Donbas, Russian soldiers. And so we proved the fact that there was Russian invasion to Ukraine and not only unknown green men. We did our work. I stayed there to fight for my values, and I think that it was worthy. I was among those who protested against occupation of Crimea. There were huge protest rallies in 2014 against occupation of Crimea in Russia. So it was still possible. The work was still possible. I think it was meaningful, and it's not. I hope that this story is not over.
Please.
Hello. So you said we are living in a world that liberal values are decreasing all over the world, outside Europe and even within Europe. I always thought of Europe as like, I don't know, birthplace of liberal democracy. And I was thinking like Europe has a higher responsibility in defending liberal democratic values. Do you think European Union right now is acting in a responsible way according to like the power and the values they are advocating for, or like they are not doing like enough? And if not, what do you expect them to do? Or yeah,
is Europe doing enough?
I don't even know if it's even appropriate to criticize European Union. Everyone is criticizing European Union these days. So like, and we all know how imperfect your European Union is, but still, my daughter lives in Berlin, and she is a very European kid. And I live in New York, and I always I'm trying to convince her to go to the college to America. And I recently realized, talking to her and to her friends and to children of my friends who live in other European countries, I unexpectedly realized that European Gen Z, they talk about America just the way how European kids were talking about Soviet Union 50 years ago, as of huge authoritarian force, empire that is a threat to European democracy. I think that in terms of democratic values, Europe is a very important place because the number of idealists that live in different European countries is quite high, and that's important. I'm always focusing on people and what people do believe. I think that matters. I do know that a lot of people in Europe believe in democracy. I hope that in other places as well. I hope that those people who believe in American democracy would prevail as well. So, but it's really hard to talk about European Union as the union. But we know all those obvious problems. But I believe in people.
May I just add to this a little plea, because one of the most hard-nosed people in national politics at the moment is Mark Carney, the Prime Minister of Canada, who has got some very sobering things to say to the world about this is a rupture, not a transition. But he recently in Yerevan said that the new world order must come from Europe. And I gulped for a moment and I thought, dear Mr. Carney, come to Europe and let me show you our discussions about our pension systems and about trying to build a fighter plane between two countries and all sorts of interesting things, and nothing seems to work. But there is an interesting rationale to that, which is that in a world of autocrats and authoritarian regimes, a boring union of states that actually abide by international agreements becomes a very attractive point for other middling powers who do not have the power themselves to call the shots, but who like the idea that there is a reliable partner around, and that may yet give Europe an unexpected weight in the coming years, because it become a reliable partner is at the moment actually a unique selling point in international politics. So perhaps that's quite an interesting little observation that Mr. Carney allowed us there. Can I just ask the last two questions to be called together, and then we can take them together? There was a gentleman there, and there was a gentleman here. Yes.
Oh, yeah, an easy question for you. Nobody can predict the future, but what's your best guess as to what happens to Russian ruling classes after Putin?
There's an easy question, and the gentleman over there, you don't want to ask your question anymore. That's okay. Well, this is a contest between hands. I think the lady here was marginally before. Can you, yes, you've already got the microphone.
This is a short question. Some people say that Ukraine is winning the war. What do you think about that?
So here is not only the future, but also military strategy. Go ahead.
It's very hard question about winning the war, and very easy question about Russia after Putin. Winning the war is possible when Putin is gone. So that's the victory, the real victory. I don't think that there is any other scenario, because I don't believe, at least for now, we don't see Putin's desire to stop the war. And no matter how it's hurtful to Russian economy, and it's really visible, the oil refinery in Tuapse is like 15% of Russian export, and it's destroyed. So yes, it's bad, but still he had plan A. He didn't have plan B, and he still believes in his plan A. And he started, like in Stanley Kubrick's movie, he started loving the war. He loves the war. He needs this war. He doesn't have a plan to end it, no matter how bad it is. So I think the end of the war is his departure. And that brings us to the first question. I don't have that ball. Crystal ball, but I can advise you to watch a movie, Armando Iannucci's Death of Stalin. I think that's a very nice movie that can inspire you to think of current Russian bureaucrats trying to guess who is who. Is always a nice game. I think that's a very realistic scenario.
Michal Tsigan, thank you very much for answering our questions today and giving us a few insights into the Russia that we might not have otherwise. And ask you, thank you for being such an engaged audience and thoughtful audience. And thank you for your questions. And well, have a wonderful evening until the next time, right here with another fascinating guest. Thank you all.
Thank you so much.
Das war MQ zum Hören. Vielen Dank, dass ihr heute dabei wart. Bitte abonniert MQ zum Hören, um keine neue Folge zu verpassen. Wir freuen uns natürlich auch sehr über eine Bewertung oder einen Kommentar. Bis zur nächsten Folge von MQ zum Hören. Alles Gute und auf Wiederhören.